Hi, and welcome to the third season of the Duck Industry Podcast, bringing you personal and truthful conversations. We acknowledge that the cultural establishment of which we are part still needs to undergo a fundamental transformation of true inclusivity. The Duck Industry Podcast is meant as a source of inspiration to envision a different way, a better way. We want to evolve together and dedicate ourselves to the work we have done so far and are committed to practicing further. We believe the future of this field lies in the power of the wide range of experiences, aesthetics, storytelling, and perspectives that you all have to offer. It's a great joy to welcome back our glorious partners and curators, the POC2 Programmers of Color Collective and the What's Up with Dogs podcast. We are also happy to introduce new collaborators, our colleagues from Kino Pravda Institute from Serbia, Belgrade. We look much forward to highlighting and celebrating the ideas, themes, and discussions our colleagues will bring to this. Duck Industry is funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contribution. Enjoy!
Jihan, thank you so much for being on the show with us again. It's just such a pleasure to reconnect with you, especially after the amazing conversation about archives that we had last year for Doc Leipzig. So I'm excited to do this part two.
Same here. In just a year, so much changes.
Exactly. So I just want to start off by asking how you are. I know the world is going through a lot of changes. You know, here in the U.S., we're dealing with our own not so little slow moving coup, which has been in the news. But how are you? And I don't know if you want to get into where you are.
Yes, I'm in Burkina Faso, stuck in the middle of a coup d'etat. The first 2 days were quite adventurous, let's say. Just like watching tanks and helicopters waltzing together through my window. But things have calmed down a bit. There's a lot of tension and there's a lot of people stranded, including myself. But let's see, it's really sad to see this country, which has FESPACO happens in February, and it's the biggest African film festival. And talking about archive, they had just gotten the okay to start a whole heritage space for film.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But now they're gone. So let's see what happens.
We'll see what happens. But for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with FESPACO, do you want to talk about what that is? It's actually one of the biggest film festivals on the continent of Africa. It's been around for 40 something years.
It's 50. The coming edition is the 52nd edition.
Okay. 52 years.
54. 54 years. It's the biggest film festival. It started with a demand from the African filmmakers to have their own space to be able to show the films from their own perspective. And Ousmane Samben and Tahir Shreya being the Tunisian, they sort of came up with this idea. And that's why it's a biennial, because it happens 1 year in Burkina Faso and the following year in Tunisia, the Carthage days.
Right. And they accept films from folks who are part of the African diaspora. Like, I know so many African American filmmakers who have over the years who have screened their projects there. So they're a very welcoming festival for everybody of African descent as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think this was a big thing because there used to be a diaspora section that is kind of on the sidelines. But starting last edition, the diaspora section became part of the main competition and completely integrated into the festival as it as a mainstream. They used to have this prize called the Paul Robeson Prize, which was for the diaspora, but now they enter competition as though they're Africans, so it doesn't matter where you're from, as long as I mean, it's a huge event. They say that Burkina, Ouagadougou, the capital, goes from 600,000 people, and over the 10 days of the sparkle goes up to 2 million people.
Wow.
People come from, I mean, lots of Ghanaians come by car. You have a whole industry of arts and crafts. They all come from Mali. So it really is, and probably remains, the truly Pan-African space.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I hope to be able to attend one year, at some point. So, because I've just heard so many wonderful things about it. So I actually want to kind of begin with some of my reflections from our last conversation. And it was just really great to talk to you and about archives, because I'm just, for people who are listening to this podcast for the first time, I got started in the documentary industry like through archives, and I still do archive research on the side because I just love looking up stuff and I love history. But like talking to you, like it was challenging for me, like in a really great way, because a lot of my mindset and thinking around archives is still rooted in this like capitalistic, colonialistic model. And you have a great way of like stopping those thoughts and like making people realize like, okay, this is the perspective that you're coming from. And when I was, the language I was using, and I think I would kind of like try to reframe it. And you were like, no. I don't need you. I don't know if you use like, no. But it just really, really, I love it when I have conversations with people and you just, the way I describe it is you make me grow new neurons, like new pathways of thinking that I didn't know that I needed. So I just really appreciated that. And it just kind of speaks to your passion about this whole topic, but also it was a really great lesson on like on how you could challenge people like in a good and positive way. But also, I mean, I think I was receptive to it too. So
I have to say, first of all, thank you for the compliments. It's exactly what I need in my disheartened situation. But I think it's more about, I think the approach to archive over the past few years have been challenged for all of us. And being able to say, okay, which vantage point am I going to look at this from?
Right.
And I'm clearly rooted in a perspective from the South. And the more I advance, and actually that's why I said things in 1 year, things change. I myself am challenged the whole time, because you think that we finally said, okay, now we're not going to do this anymore, that's what it's about, and then somebody asks you a question and you say, okay, hold on a minute, I have to rethink now. And that's been happening over the past year quite considerably, because somebody asked me, what do you actually mean by archive? And I kind of stopped and I said, archive. And it's as I was answering, I started thinking, actually, what are archives? In our head, archives are always connected to celluloid or connected to the image,
right?
And then I said, well, the way we use it is, how do we use visual, old visuals? And then and he said, so we didn't have archive before celluloid arrived in Africa. And I'm like, okay, let me stop here and start thinking, what do I actually mean by archive? And I think over the past year, as you know, we talked last time about this whole idea of the Liberate the Image manifesto. Right. But the Liberate the Image Manifesto was talking literally about the image.
Right.
And all the different points of access, restitution, and I'll come back to access restitution later. But I think what happened with Liberate the Archive is that it brought people on board that wanted to liberate memory and the
yes
to reconnect with our past, which then posed a really interesting question, a question that Sarah Hartman poses in a lot of her writings, especially Venus in Two Acts. It's the question, what about the missing frames? What about the silenced images? What about all these things we know nothing about?
Right, right.
Do we reconstitute our past based on what was decided should exist? Or do we have an obligation, especially filmmakers and artists and musicians and artists of all kinds, do we have an obligation to reassess and appropriate this past in a way where we ourselves create these missing images?
Yes, I love that. I love that. And I really feel like that is really one of the joys of like working in this documentary field is, you know, having the opportunity to rediscover, or even discover like these hidden histories and stories about ourselves. And when I was prepping for this call, the idea, the concept of like memory came up to me. And I'm going to just tell a little story, and I would love to hear your comments about it. But I grew up in the state of Georgia. I'm one generation out of Jim Crow. And my family, my ancestors were enslaved in what's now Athens, Georgia, Oconee County. And then after, you know, slavery in theory ended, they were sharecroppers. So I still have a lot of extended family, you know, in Athens and Ocoee County, and it's really, really country there. And I just remember going there for family reunions, and they would have, my relatives would put up bottle trees. So they put the trees, and they would be trees with branches, and then they would put bottles on the branches. And it wasn't until I was in college that I discovered, when I was taking the anthropology class, that that was a practice that was essentially brought over from my descendants who were in the Congo. And it's like a way of like protecting a home from spirits, kind of like the eyes, you know, on amulets, like throughout like North Africa, you know, that help protect people. And when I think about that, it really makes me think about, but well, it made me really think like how we held on to these remnants of memories and kind of recreated it. But I really didn't understand what it was referring to until like I was in college. And it just made me think about how like memory can actually be a gateway to kind of helping to these fractured memories, we can get a gateway to kind of rediscovering these forgotten histories. You know, because we hold on to these things.
Of course. And over the past year, maybe it's worth underlining that over this past year, I've been running this archive program called People's Stories Past and Present. And while we were preparing for that, one of the, you know, obviously, archive is a huge discussion. So who do you choose? Who comes on board and who talks about what? What is the main topic? How do we focus in a way where we need to get to the bottom of something, but then through that focus, we can go wider? And one of the things we chose as really the backbone of this program is this distinction between official history and memory.
Yes.
Based on the writing of Kojo Eshun. who's a Ghanaian artist, who's theorized this idea, the distinction between memory and official history. And I think it's really, really interesting, because if you take any documented moment of history that becomes part of the mythology of our history, and just stop at that moment and get the people who were alive during that moment to tell you their stories.
Yes.
The way it flops out, the way you understand what that event actually meant, very often it's very different from what the official narrative has kind of fixed in our history books.
Right. So,
and I think that we're also at this moment where I think the more we know about archive, the more we digitize archive, the more questions there are, not the more answers.
Yes. Because,
like, you know, I came across this whole, you know, huge, big amount of archive. And great, how do I contextualize this? How do I know who filmed it? How do I place it? I have this one really interesting story when I was doing my last film, Egypt's Modern Pharaohs, and I had a lot of archive, and in a lot of the pictures, there was this one guy who keeps popping up. And
Yes.
And I couldn't, you know, there's nobody who could tell me who's this guy. And so the archives were given to me as this event or as that event. And when finally somebody said, oh, this guy is a guy who was on the Syrian side when we were the UAR. And the UAR only existed from 1958 to 1961.
Okay.
So suddenly all these archives that were given to me under different names and different eras, you could suddenly pin down, actually, wherever this guy is, it's only within this time.
This 2 year period, 2 or 3 year period. Right.
And that completely played havoc with everything that had been given to me and the context it had been given to me. So, but then having said what I said, it makes it seem like an impossible task to deal with archive. But I don't actually think it is, because I think it's a matter of attitude. And now you'll see how much I've changed since last year. I think it's a matter of attitude, because my attitude up until last year was, if we have the footage, if we see it, somewhere there's a truth in there. But my attitude right now is that, why is it that I'm presuming this is a truth?
Right.
It's not necessarily a truth. It's an element
of a truth.
Fragment. It's a
fragment.
What we are to do with these fragments, in my opinion, we appropriate them. We tell our stories from our vantage point through appropriating these images and contextualizing them through these oralities that we've been handed down. It's like your tree and the bottles on the trees. Now, if you have that bit of information, you can actually interpret the whole scene.
Right. And
yeah.
No, but I was going to say, I mean, I guess we give a lot of weight to, you know, these celluloid archives because they are primary sources, and we give a lot of credence to those primary sources because they are essentially first-hand accounts. But we still have to recognize what you're saying is, we still have to recognize our first kind of accounts from a specific particular perspective. So, like you said, it's part of the picture, but we have to be conscious that it's not the entire picture.
But the truth is that all the celluloid we have until the mid-60s is through the eyes of our colonizers.
It's through that gaze, yes.
There's no doubt. I think we talked about it at length last time, so I don't particularly want to get into that again.
Right.
But that vantage point, I just did a piece for the Berlin Biennial called Complexifying Restitution, Notes to Self.
Okay.
Now, here I was delighted about this whole notion of restitution, that the door to claiming restitution is open, and we were all sort of, let's go. But then suddenly you realize that the complexity of restitution is way beyond just taking it, okay?
Yes, okay.
The 2-3 countries I've been working with, the state of their archive is in absolute tatters. Now, it's not because it's in tatters that that's the problem. The problem is that it's in tatters because they don't want the archive to not be in tatters, because archive is part of the politics of our countries.
Yes, yes.
The mythologies of independence are based on these archives. Contesting individuals can be based on these archives. So this image as the truth is actually very often a danger to people in power in many of our countries. So we don't even have access. Like, we need to get archive from Egypt is practically impossible.
Right, right.
Senegal, I mean, the state of the archive, I sat there and wept, literally. So restitution is fine, but what is it we're restituting? Who are we restituting it from? Because a lot of, here I am in a country with a coup d'etat, okay?
Right.
Now, the coup d'etat of today is going to try and discredit or have a different narrative.
The history, yeah, that's happening. Exactly, so right.
Our restituting our memory and our histories that have a minimum common denominator that we can actually say this is our history is not just from the colonizers. It's from our leaders too.
Yes, we really have to be I'm thinking about that phrase, you know, history is like written by the victors, you know, and we really have to learn how to just question these things. But also I think that's well, one thing I wanted to ask too, sorry, I wanted to just go back to something you said when you're talking about the state of the various archives. So when you're visiting these archives, like what specifically, like are things are like these documents, you know, celluloid, etc., these artifacts, are they not are they kept, are they not cataloged, or like the facilities where they're kept, they're just like they're not protected, so they're like deteriorating? Like, what exactly, when you're saying these archives are in an advanced state. Yeah, what exactly are you talking about?
Let me put it this way, okay? When I first went to the a certain country's archive a few years ago, they had 1,500 canisters that were not, that had no vinegar and that were in very good shape, okay?
Right.
A few years later, they were 900. Okay. This year, which is only 4 years later, they have 250 left.
Okay? Wow. Okay.
So over less than 10 years, we've gone to literally not even the quarter of the archives that existed, that are in a state. I don't even know what to tell you. I can show you an image, but that's not going to help in a podcast.
I mean, right, right.
We're talking about a celluloid reel that is all stuck together and of years of dust and crust and the argentique, that silver residue has made it all stick together.
It's right, right. Just deteriorated. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Deteriorated is not even the right word.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a real, real state.
Right, right. Okay.
So, right. Mm-hmm. Let's say I went, it took me 18 months to manage to go to the place where they actually keep the reels. Mm-hmm. I would say totally deteriorated and left in a state of madness. I'd like you just to
look
find
at
the
it.
Words with me.
So what we're looking at for our listeners is a bunch of film canisters, like some empty, like just piled on the floor, covered in dust and dirt. And some of the canisters are warped. Okay. So what I'm looking at is a big old pile of, looks like film, but yes. It's covered in so much dust. That
it looks like a plate of spaghetti.
Yeah, it does. Like gray spaghetti. That's what it looks like. Exactly.
So I mean, obviously, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not the case of absolutely everything, but
right.
When you're faced with a huge amount of, and several countries that are in that state,
mm-hmm.
The next question is whose responsibility? And when we talk about restitution,
yes,
restitution of what? And mm-hmm. How? I'm not going to get to whom, because that's another debate.
Also. That's a whole other discussion, right? Mm-hmm.
Because before we start just pointing fingers, we find the space of our own to decide what is it we need these archives for.
And right.
In our heads, and me being the first, I'm the total archive treasure hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And now everybody's on the archive tip, but everybody's on preservation and conservation. My question is, what is it should we preserve and why?
Right, right.
This madness of just wanting to preserve, who gets to choose what to preserve? Because once right. We preserve it, then it becomes part of our history.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I hope I'm not sounding depressed or
no.
Disheartened by all of this, but I think the biggest bulb that came on, the sort of like the biggest understanding I got over the past year mm-hmm. is that we should look alongside this archive, orality, rituals, puppeteering.
Yes, yes, those. Yes.
We have so much.
Right.
That we could call archive.
I mean, before there was a written word, you know, people passed down stories through like oral traditions, you know, and that's an archive.
Music mm-hmm. is an archive.
Archive.
Sound is an archive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And each one of them we take for granted. So I think that we had this amazing brainstorming session for 3 days. And like with all the amazing people who've been working mm-hmm. with archive for the past 40 years,
right.
John Akonkwo, Kojo Ishun, like the Otolith Group, Tony Ejabo was the Pan-African Space Station, like people mm-hmm. really, really put their heads into archive.
Right. And
the general atmosphere was, leave the celluloid aside. We'll get to it when we need it.
Okay. Oh, that feels a little controversial to me.
It is.
Like, that made me nervous when you said that.
It's very controversial. But you know what? If what we're trying to do is trying to figure out what the narrative is.
Right.
From our side of the story, we have to be able to say, hold on a minute, let's figure out with all the different archives that have been delegated to us in our own formats. So our next session, we have a next session in Mauritania, and then the one after that in Morocco. The one in Mauritania, we're constructing around puppeteering.
Right, okay.
We have the puppeteers of the Niger and the history of puppeteering in Ségou, in Mali, along all the way down from there to Senegal, all the way to Mauritania. This is a whole visual, a whole physical format that we haven't preserved, that we haven't thought of, that we haven't compiled the evolution of these narratives. And the next one we're doing in Morocco, we're doing around the Hadra. The Hadra is basically the ritual of Sufism. And the ritual. It's all about music, orality, connecting lineages around themes.
Yes, yes.
And we know nothing about this. There's a lady who's 103 years old. The last lady who is known to know all the different recitals of the Hadra.
Wow, wow.
Nobody's ever filmed her.
Wow. And
So
I'm just blown. That gave me chills. So you
see, it is controversial. Keep the celluloid aside for the moment. Of course, it's controversial. But at the same time, maybe it's not controversial. Let's start creating our own archive for what it is we need to preserve, rather than preserve what we know was never taken by us.
Right. Oh my God. Okay. I got so many things. So, so I was in Morocco in the last century, when I was in college, and I was there for 5 months. It's like 3 months in an off-campus study program. And then I was traveling on my own, like doing my research for my senior thesis, because it's my last year in college. And I was doing, I did my research on, saint worship in Morocco. So I was traveling to these various places where there were these saints' tombs or venerations for saints. And this is in Morocco, there's not any official canonization for saints like there is like in the Catholic Church. But there were these certain places that were known to have, you know, certain properties, and they happened to be where places where women worship, particularly in towns where there were mosques, but the mosques were like too small, so the women weren't going to them, you know. And in my research, before I went, I was reading all these books like from the 1900s and from this anthropologist, I think his name was like Westermark. And I went to this one particular tomb of a saint, which is actually at Agadir, which is known for at the Kasbah at Agadir, which is known for its like healing properties. Like people go there and they say prayers, and you know, in theory, like, these miracles happen.
Each saint has his function, by the way.
Each saint has its function. And I think this particular saint was named Leila Tatkekuts, I think it was the name, I'm trying to remember. But it was interesting because while I was there, I also had the opportunity to go to a few Ganawa ceremonies and in these ceremonies, kind of like Vudun here on this part of the continent, this part of the U.S., this part of the world, where they play these particular drumming rhythms, and the saints come down and they mount people and they take over people. And one of them, I remember I went to one session, and one of them was actually named Tatkekuts, Leila Tatkekuts. And then when I was kind of like going deeper to the research, actually Tatkekuts has this etymology like in Hebrew. And So essentially, these Muslim people who are practicing this Ganawa, who are practicing Ganawa, are actually worshiping a saint that potentially has like Jewish roots. You know, because like Judaism was throughout like throughout North Africa. You know, and you know Jews lived throughout North Africa. So it was like all these like little ties together that these little.
But the Ganawa. The Ganawa rhythm,
yes,
is very anchored in slavery.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not really about. I think the saints then become the saint worship space is a Muslim one.
It's a Muslim, right? Mm-hmm.
But it's not dissociated. As far as Muslims are concerned, all three religions are an inherent part of Islam.
Exactly, right.
So this distinction, whether the saint, it depends when the saint was living, because if that saint was in a period when Islam hadn't arrived, doesn't make him less of a saint.
Exactly.
I think what's more interesting for me, or alongside what you're saying, and all these question marks we need to even address. Mm-hmm. We don't know. I don't know the answer to what you're saying. And I think very few people do, because we haven't spent the time to figure it out. I think for me, what was really interesting, and it's part of our program, is this separation between the North and the South of the continent has been systematic.
Yes.
We see, and Senegal and Morocco being a perfect example, is that since the 15th century, this saint worship between the two countries has been going up and down through the Tijaneia since kingdom come, since the 15th century, and it never stopped, and it was never interrupted.
And right.
The narrative, be they from Morocco or from Senegal, are complementary. And the current division between the North and South of the continent, that you don't get to know both sides of the coin.
Right.
And it's connecting these. And when I talk about silenced images or missing frames and all of that, these are the kind of little details that I think, once we start asking the questions, there's a flood of things. I'm sure your parents, if you ask the right questions, will tell you some oral history that they have from their childhood that we can't find in books. Our problem today is that if it's not in a bibliography, if it's not logged, if it's not within an archive fund that makes you pay a lot of money for it, then it doesn't exist.
And that's not true. It almost feels like we had need to take a like almost like a scientific approach to this. And and when I say that, what I'm meaning is science is always like willing to take in like new information, is always like and willing to like reevaluate what we think we know. And I'm just going to kind of give it a quick example. So Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, they call him the, you know, he's an astrophysicist, like really famous here in the US, but they call him the Pluto killer, because like in his research, he discovered that actually Pluto was actually not an actual planet. And like people got so angry about that. But now like that's accepted, you know, so it almost seems like we need to take this science approach that, okay, yes, we do have these archives. We have these, this written and celluloid word, but we need to be open to that shifting based on new knowledge that we rediscover.
Yes. And I think that widening the space of the concept of archive is fundamentally important at the point we're at.
Right.
Because, I mean, all these, you know, we're at a moment, especially where independence is I'm here in Ouagadougou because I am one of the mentors in the Ouaga Lab. Okay. The Ouaga Lab brings all these young filmmakers. And if you see the amount of films that are that young 25, 26 year olds want to know about history. There are at least three history documentaries. And, you know, somebody, one of the guys was saying, yeah, but this and this and that happened. And I'm like, okay, what dates are you talking about? You cannot ensure that it happened if you don't know the wider space of what was happening around it. And how and there is a desire to reconnect with a reality that comes from a space we recognize.
Yes, now, yes, absolutely.
It's as simple as that.
Right, right. Yeah, because there's so many, there's like, if we look carefully, there are so many connections that we can, that, you know, that we can explore, you know, if we don't look at these things as, you know, static, not changing, you know, artifacts.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the good examples, I think, is that the most concrete oral history we have is the griot.
And yes, yes. Yeah,
the griot and the narration of the whole epic of the Mandeng. But that's from the 13th century onwards. Okay. Now, in the midst of that, some of these griots became Muslim and started adjusting that history itself and
based on Islam.
That. Yes. So you have two different narratives of that same history that actually say the same thing. One that injects Islam and the other that remains animist. Now, I'm not saying that we should take one or the other, but it's widening that space and being aware. And then you understand what the elements you can use. For me, archive is a tool to help me think, a tool to help me understand.
Right, right.
And yeah, a tool to help me ask more questions.
Exactly, exactly. Exactly. When I was in Morocco, I remember I was like with my in the living room with my host family, and we were watching TV, and I was telling them that I actually been to like these Ganawa ceremonies, and they had never been to them. They're like, ooh, they were like fascinated because they always had heard about the Ganawa. And on TV, an American documentary came on about the Black church in the U.S., and they showed people kind of getting the spirit. You know, which is something I grew up with. So, you know, people get spirit and then they dance, you know, et cetera. And my host family, they said, oh, look, American, Black American Ganawa. And it kind of made me think about this history that seems to be like that's throughout.
I'm not sure that do the Ganawa do get into a trance?
The ceremonies are yes, because the ceremonies I went to, yes, they went, yes, they go into a trance. I was the first one I went to. I remember I was sitting next to this woman and we were like having a conversation in French, and a particular rhythm played, and like her eyes changed, and she just got up and started dancing. And I also had friends who, when I was living in Florida, who are Santeria initiates. So I went to ceremonies there. And, you know, this just this common tradition of like drumming and using music to bring on spirits to get messages from the spirits. And but obviously like these are like different traditions, but it's like really fascinating that there's this, those of us who are in this part of the world, like who are descendants of those who are enslaved have like held on to this tradition, even though like it's different in different places.
But I mean, so. one of our participants in that brainstorming of the artists we're working with is Kudus Onikeku, okay? Because he's a very well-known contemporary dancer. And so contemporary dance itself
is an archive.
Is an archive. Yes. Our body is an archive.
Mm-hmm.
And how the whole Yoruba tradition is yes. actually the basis. If you hear the drums of the Yoruba tradition,
mm-hmm.
it's binary. It's the basis of computer science.
Oh, okay. So talk more about that.
I'd rather he talk about it. Because
okay.
He says
okay.
It really
we'll have to talk to him. Okay.
Yeah, no, so it's the binaries of the drum, the Yoruba rituals.
Right, right.
It's like if you take them into ones and zeros, it's the basis, okay. You know, it's as simple as that.
Oh my God, I haven't thought about that. Oh my God, I had to read more up on that. I love yeah. that. Okay.
Yeah, and of course he went into a lot of length into the whole Yoruba tradition and how it's connected and how the overground and the underground. And like, you know, I'm Egyptian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As an Egyptian, we do not function in linear mode.
Mm.
We function 12 hours of morning and 12 hours of night. So there's the visible and the invisible, the overworld and the underworld. And mm-hmm. they're both sides of the same coin.
Right.
The gods okay. of, yeah. So anyway, we're going deep into.
We're going deep. You're blowing my mind.
deep into the spiritual world. But I think you see, that's an element. That's another element that I think is what it, the whole element of spirituality has mm-hmm. disappeared from the narrative. But
yes.
all our cultures are deeply rooted in the spiritual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, we don't have any visual material that will transmit that. Does
right.
that mean permit it? Or do we find other tools to integrate that level of narrative as an mm-hmm. archive through the orality, through dance, through puppeteering, through all these different elements that have existed for ages?
Right. There's this anthropologist, and I'm gonna like see if I can look her up. Maya Durnham, I think was her name. Anyway, okay, I'll try to remember who. But she was originally from Russia, and she settled here actually in California. And she did these amazing, like, I guess what we would kind of like actually call experimental documentaries, she was also a dancer. And she has this phenomenal film about Vodun. And she recorded these dances like in the 1940s. And she slows them down to kind of show you the nuances and how they're specific to the various orishas that are being like called down onto people. And it's like this phenomenal way of like, it was this amazing way of kind of like documenting the subtleties of these various, I actually call them histories that we normally don't see as histories.
You see, that reminds me of a film called mm-hmm. Specialized Technique, made by Onyeka Igwe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a ritual dance that is obviously filmed by the colonial film unit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what she does is that she asks questions to the character inside the archive.
Okay.
And this interaction between her voice and how all the questions around that specific ritual,
mm-hmm.
because obviously part of the ritual is captured.
Mm-hmm.
And like she would ask her, did they tell you to not look at the camera? Is this the move you usually do? Or is it a choreography? And all these are questions that she's addressing to the archive, which is very interesting because then you look at the archive, you get a sense of the dance and the ritual, but mm-hmm. with these questions in mind, you can actually go do some research.
Right. Yeah, it's really, it's so fascinating. Oh, I looked, found her. Her name is Maya Deren, D-E-R-E-N. Like, her most famous film is like Meshes of the Afternoon. It's all over YouTube. It's like, it's hella cool. But yeah. So, I mean, I guess what you're asking us to do, what you're challenging us to do as people, is in a way to kind of like maybe look at our own, like look at ourselves as archives too.
We are.
Yeah.
We are. I mean, yesterday I was saying that I've been obviously working with archive, and over the past years I've been preparing this whole program around the archive. And just in August, my flat was flooded and I had to bring out all my archive. And I suddenly realized, oh my God, how will anyone actually understand what all of this is? Why should I leave behind all of this? So the same questions that I've been asking, what is there to preserve and in what context, and what do you need to keep it?
Right.
What kind of indications you need to keep? Or does one just leave it and say whatever, you know, throw the whole lot if you want? So I think basically just as a punchline, I've been very confused over the past year as to where to draw the line, where to put my energy. Of course, I'm not saying that forget celluloid, because I don't want to forget celluloid. However, alongside celluloid, there is not a hierarchy of priority. Celluloid is not the top priority.
Right.
Alongside the celluloid, there's a whole host of things that we should start considering archive. Now, the punchline is, how do we do this? How do we think in terms of how to proceed in terms of collecting? I'm a firm believer that every time we use an archive, we create a new archive ourselves. Be it dance, so it's this reappropriation that I'm very into at the moment. Appropriate that image. And as a person coming from that space, interrogate it, interpret it, and then whatever you do with it is a new form of archive. It doesn't diminish. It only adds layers. It's that layering that I think is very exciting.
Right. So when you ask that question, and I'm like, and you could correct me if I'm like not if I'm saying this wrong, but you ask the question like why should you preserve, or like what needs to be preserved, or and like my answer is that because we need it, you know, because we need it. But I mean, I also get, you know, trying to determine
why do we need it, if you recognize that all we're left with are fragments that do not tell the story, and that these fragments are taken from a vantage point that does not actually tell our history the way we lived it, but rather the decision that that's how it should be portrayed. Maybe some of it should be preserved, but maybe some of it shouldn't. I'm saying that the question of preservation, the question of preservation is a real one.
Yes.
It's not just spend hours and just digitize everything you see. Why?
Now let me ask you this.
And who makes that decision?
Right.
Now, let me give you an example. Guinea-Bissau got a huge fund for a wonderful Portuguese filmmaker, Philippe Césaire, to preserve some of the archive there. Bless her heart, she did an amazing job. But obviously, not everything can be preserved.
Right.
Who gets to choose what is important and what isn't? Who gets to choose?
Yes.
That this film needs to be restored and then now goes through the circuit and becomes the best known Guinean film. Maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, maybe it may have just been like one of the few Guinean films that was out there, and there are other films that were out there that we don't know about because, you know, they didn't have the resources.
Or whoever chose to digitize this one and not that one. I guess bottom line is that it's complicated and it's a very, very long haul. And we need as many people and then as many brains and as many alternatives to just collect pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah, because I guess a lot of, I mean, not I guess, but a lot of what is chosen to quote unquote like be preserved is based on subjectivity. It's someone's opinion about, like, is usually, this worthy or is it not?
And it's usually the opinion of someone working in a colonial archive because they're the only ones who have the means.
Right, right. So do you think that we would need to kind of like make these decisions? And I'm going to reference Allen Ginsberg. You know, when he talks about writing, he talks about how you have to like kill your darlings. And what that means is, you know, when you're writing something, a poem, a novel, you know, you may write a lot of like great things, but how you had to also think about like how this particular line or this particular paragraph contributes to the story. And if it doesn't necessarily contribute to the story, you should remove it, i.e. kill your darlings.
In documentary, when you have to cut out a sequence, you say kill your babies.
Kill your babies,
And it's a very, very hard decision to make. But again, don't get me wrong. I am not saying there shouldn't be preservation. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be restoration. I'm saying that as much as I was really excited and trying to get a scanner and trying to do this, it was all about the celluloid. Suddenly a number of questions made me wonder whether focusing on that is not actually, and that's why complexifying restitution, notes to self, it was really, I was asking myself, what is this about? Where do I reach the end of this? Do I need to say that? Because at the same time, the way we use visual archives today is within a commercial context.
So
voila. So I think clarity on that and engagement, because researchers, PhD students, ethnographers, anthropologists, sociologists, each one is going to look from a different perspective.
Yeah, but we'll bring our own. We bring ourselves to like what we're, it's what we do. There's no such thing as objectivity.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
As an artist, I believe who better is there as an artist to reappropriate these existing narratives in order to connect the past with the present. The past on its own, just as a nostalgia, is not very beneficial, really.
And a lot of times it's inaccurate too.
Yes. So we, at least as far as I'm concerned, I'm dipping into the past in order to clarify the present and hopefully the future. So I think if that is the angle through which you are pursuing archive, this connection, this need to understand the today is very instrumental in all its formats.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
reinterpreting it is part of growing the archive.
Because yes.
Mm-hmm. Just taking the archive and keeping it fixed.
Right. That's not
in a time
right. mm-hmm.
when I use it today,
mm-hmm.
I have to breathe into it, part of the life of today, because whoever is going to come in the future then gets this uninterrupted chain of moments. Mm-hmm. And that's why preservation in and of itself, just for the sake of preservation, I'm not sure the amount of money and effort to the exclusion of all other formats.
Right.
It mm-hmm. is the most beneficial thing at the moment.
Right.
So wow. Let's put dance, orality, puppeteering, music, sound, all these things are, but rituals.
Rituals, yes. Those are, yeah, I mean, the rituals, like, I mean, yeah, it's an art. Yeah, I love it. Like, rituals are an archive.
Our body is an archive.
Our body is an archive. Yes. And I mean, that's so true when you say that our body is an archive, because I'm thinking also from the perspective of like psychology and trauma, and how our body like holds onto things that we haven't, you know, whether consciously or unconsciously, that we haven't had time to process, you know, particularly in when we experience trauma. Our bodies are memories, you know, our bodies are memories. So, well, we have been talking for like an hour now. And I would love to go on, but I think we probably need to wrap up. So I just want to ask if you have like any last words or any thoughts. I mean, this has been like, for me, this has been like a wonderful conversation. Like, I love engaging with you. I can't wait to like just sit down with you like in person, so we can just like go deep into this. We'll make that happen soon.
Yeah.
But I'm so appreciate you taking the time, especially, being where you are right now. Yo, cooing it up.
Yeah, I'm not really laughing about this one. Get me out.
I know.
Of here.
Well, I'm laughing like to like, you know, to yeah. kind of like, you know, it's not a funny situation, but sometimes yeah. like laughter kind of like breaks the tension.
Yes.
But please be safe, and then please offer any like last words that you like to leave us with today.
Well, I guess my last word is, let's work on how the links of the chain can continue, be it from north or south, east or west, past or present. We're all in this together. And the more the links within this chain are uninterrupted, the more understanding we'll have amongst all of us.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jihan, for being on the show today.
Thank you.